to the L. Barrio, you know we got flow. East Harlem, home of the boat, the show. Listen, podcast dishing, easy going. On the show where the hot air's always blowing. Downloading, never miss an episode. Keep it real, always serve it Alamo. New York, New York, if you can make it here, you know the rest, you can make it anywhere.
It's episode 91 of the Brad Boatner Show. Our guest today is John Eisenberg, author of many books, including most recently 10 Gallon War, the NFL's Cowboys, the AFL's Texans, and the feud for Dallas's pro football future. He's also a contributor to BaltimoreRavens.com. Thank you very much for being on the show today, John. It's great to have you.
Well, thanks. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I really like this book. It's a great look into professional football's birth in Dallas, kind of taking it in the next drive of becoming that big sport in America. And it's very interesting. So Lamar Hunt is this oil-rich businessman in Dallas, and he wants a football team in Dallas. You know, he's had a lot of experience. He played at SMU, and he's trying to either relocate or get an expansion team from the NFL, and he just keeps coming up into a lot of stumbling blocks in the process.
Well, he was 26 years old. I think that was the problem. And he was trying to convince these old lions of the NFL, like George Halas, that he should have a team. And these guys were not about to let some little, what they thought was a spoiled rich kid, have a team. They just didn't want to let him into their game. And the reality was, this was pre-expansion. In the late 50s, the NFL had 12 franchises and had really no interest in expanding. They had read incorrectly sort of the coming growth of this whole sports world in the United States and the expansion, baseball, football, all sorts of things. But the NFL had misread that, but they were trying to hang on to just 12 teams, so they wanted no part of Lamar.
And it was interesting, he comes up with this whole idea to have a completely separate league, basically on a plane ride. And I was just yesterday on the plane for like 10 hours, and I feel completely worthless. I didn't come up with such a great idea.
Yeah, well, he did. It's actually a pretty famous story that it was on an American Airlines flight from Miami. He'd gone to try to talk his way into buying part of the then Chicago Cardinals. He was flying back to Dallas, and the owner of the Cardinals at that time told him that, I've had people from other cities coming to try to buy my team, including Houston. It was another oil guy. And the light bulb just came on for Lamar. He got a cab to the airport and got on the flight, and it just sort of came to him. It was like, well, I want a team. This guy in Houston wants a team. There's like six other cities that are major cities that want teams and don't have them. And the NFL is really sort of not allowing us to play. So I think there is enough interest there for a new league. So truly a simple thought and an absolute moment of genius.
What I thought was really interesting, too, is you brought up George Halas, and we always think, legendary Bears coach. But in the book, you explore the idea that he was actually incredibly influential in NFL operations, and he was almost, to a degree, like a de facto commissioner. Almost nothing got approved without his say on the matter.
Yes, and that is, I will say that. I mean, that's an accurate depiction of Halas's role. He had his hand in many, many things in the NFL, the 40s, the 50s, even into the 60s. And certainly the team in Dallas, I mean, he's basically the puppet master there. And they formed an expansion. The government the government, the antitrust, there was an antitrust committee in the Congress that was sniffing around. They were mad at the NFL and at baseball for not expanding. So the NFL put together an expansion committee. So they said, and the expansion committee was George Halas. That was it. He was the expansion committee, and it had never met, according to George. So he was very much the strong-willed sort of guy that was the conscience of the NFL, and he's the one who decided we cannot. Once Lamar said we're going to start this league, we're going to put a team in Dallas. He's the one that said we can't just give him this fertile market.
And what was so funny to me was that it's this incredibly gruff guy, this George Halas, you know, no decision gets made, everybody, you know, bends to his will, and yet his nickname was Papa Bear. It just seems tough to, it seems tough to take a guy seriously that goes by that kind of moniker.
Yeah, well, warm and cuddly he wasn't, despite the Papa Bear moniker. He was, I mean, I think if he liked you, life was pretty good, but he was a competitive, old, scratchy, angry guy, and he was, but you know, that's what it took. I mean, that's in the era of pro football, the 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s. It was the stepchild of the sports scene. I mean, baseball was much more popular. College football was much more popular. So you needed guys like Halas that were just in there fighting, and that's what he did.
So eventually Halas decides, you know, we got to end up letting this team in Dallas go. He tries to kind of block the AFL, but Lamar Hunt almost feels obligated to these other owners that he made a pact with them. And Clint Murchison, another oil-rich businessman in Dallas, ends up getting the team. And I thought it was interesting because on the one hand, he's this incredibly wealthy guy. The Dallas Cowboys kind of like a teamed him in terms of his financial investments. But he ended up being very revolutionary in the sense of, you know, who he hired as his GM, bringing Landry on board, and kind of not bowing to pressure, keeping these guys around for several years despite a pretty weak performance right out of the gate.
Yes. In NFL history, if you look back, I mean, he was a model owner. And, I mean, he was the model pretty much on how to do it. And that is hire good people and get out of the way, talking about Clint Murchison. And the reality is he did that with his other businesses, and he was incredibly wealthy. He had his hand in everything from real estate to construction to high tech, all sorts of things. And he just got out of the way and let his people do it. Some of his other businesses, that didn't work out so well, and he wound up having financial problems years later. But football, it worked beautifully because he hired Tex Schramm, Tom Landry, and Gil Brandt. You know, those were his hires. You know, Tom Landry is in the Hall of Fame. You know, Tex Schramm is in the Hall of Fame. Just an incredible team operator, managed the team, the general manager. And Gil Brandt was a great personnel guy. So he hired these three young guys who were just really good at what they did. And, yeah, it was a slow grow. They were an expansion team. They got very little help from the NFL in the early going. They had to put a team on the field without a draft, which is just an unbelievable hardship for a franchise. I mean, they just took scraps from everybody else, basically anyone that could walk. So they were no good, and yes, they took their lumps for several years. And Murchison was the one that said, you know, we're going to be fine. We're just going to stay the course, basically. So some really simple decisions that he made were crucial. You know, to stick with his guys, stick to his guns, and it paid off in the end.
So what's interesting is out in your area, you know, there's probably plenty of people that like the local team. They might like the Redskins or the Ravens, not necessarily hate them, but when the 1960 season rolls around, it seems like lines drawn in the sand. You know, you're either a fan of the AFL Texans or you like the Cowboys. You definitely don't like both of them.
Yes, and I was a young boy in Dallas at that time. It's really the reason why I wrote the book. I mean, it's this three-year war between these teams is my experience. And it was very much so. It broke down pretty sharply. And the way it broke down was pretty much the older generations, the people that sort of had faith in institutions and things that were established. They liked the NFL. They liked the Cowboys because the NFL was established. And that was certainly the case in my family, where my grandfather bought the tickets, was an older guy, and he liked the established NFL. He wasn't going to go for those radical AFL guys in the the AFL, the Texans appealed to the younger people. You know, the 60s were coming on, and maybe the people that would wind up being in the middle of that whole scene were the ones that were more likely to go with the upstart league and the upstart team. And the AFL, they threw the ball a lot more. They were more racially diverse, and it was just more of a progressive situation. A little hard scrabble at first, but progressive, and so. You know, the people in Dallas that leaned that way, they went to the Texans, the young people for sure.
I thought that's interesting you bring up the diversity because, yeah, it seemed like the AFL was much more accommodating to black players. You know, at the time, the Redskins owner wasn't even interested in having black players. So that seemed to kind of give them an edge, too, in terms of quality of players on the field. There were plenty of guys that would probably have wanted to go to the NFL, but they'd be much more welcome to the AFL.
Yes, the AFL definitely moved the pro football farther along on that path. And yes, you're correct. I mean, George Preston Marshall was the owner of the Redskins. This was into the 1960s. They were still segregated in the early 60s. They didn't have, they'd never suited up a black player. And they were getting heat from Congress as well, and it was unbelievably embarrassing. Not that he was embarrassed, but it was for the franchise an embarrassing period. But the AFL was definitely that way, and part of the reason was, as Lamar said, I mean, they were just looking for anyone that could play. They were trying to put a decent product on the field that people would pay a few bucks to go see, and certainly there were unstated quotas in the NFL when it came to African American players in the early 60s. No team had more than three or four, and they just weren't going to do it. But the AFL was more open to it because they needed players. And so, yeah, if you were black and you could play football, you had a better shot in the AFL for sure. And as a result, that is definitely the way it's skewed in the coming years, and wound up being just a great harbinger of change in sports. I mean, and I think it definitely helped the AFL catch up to the NFL quicker.
As you were saying, there's plenty of colorful characters in the book and in the leagues, and I thought one of them that was interesting was Don Meredith. I didn't really know much about him other than he's always kind of characterized as the basis for the quarterback in North Dallas 40, who's like a complete lunatic, drug addict, alcoholic, and it seemed like he was actually a little more toned down and, you know, a lovable loser almost, I guess you could say.
Well, Don Meredith as a football player for the Cowboys in those years, yeah, a lovable loser for many years. Definitely sort of a tragic figure in the history of Dallas pro football. He became very famous, of course, for Monday Night Football as a broadcaster and, you know, really popular, funny guy, and he was extremely popular as a player. But, you know, his teammates loved him. You know, he always had a joke. He was snapping his fingers. He could sing. He was tough. He played hurt. He was a great leader. I mean, the players loved him, but he never won the big one. And that is definitely, he would always get the team right there, the Cowboys right there, and something would go wrong. And so that is sort of how he is remembered. And plus, in his first few years, once he started playing, the Cowboys were no good, and he took a terrible beating, just a terrible physical beating. He was back there trying to pass in front of lousy offensive lines. And so he came into the league, and this is still true today, depends on the team you come into. He came in and played for a really bad team, and as a result, he lost a lot of games, took a beating, the fans booed him. They don't like losers, and so he had to deal with that for many years before the Cowboys were finally good. And then between that and his inability to win the big one, you know, that's sort of how he's remembered, definitely a tragic figure.
Yeah, it's funny, cause like you said, their offensive line must have been a joke, because he would go and you'd have the stat line and be like, Meredith was 7 of 42 for, you know, 6 interceptions, and it's just like, how has this guy got a job? You know, yeah. You can only be as good as your offensive line. And another thing that was interesting about Don Meredith was he kind of jump-started that whole, you know, draft wars between the two leagues, and he really could have gone to either the Texans or the Cowboys. Lamar Hunt almost thought he had the inside track because they were both SMU grads, and the Cowboys ended up slipping him away at the last second, it seemed like.
Well, they did, and this is, it's a George Halas story. The Los Angeles Rams were interested. Meredith was an All-American at SMU, and a lot of those NFL teams were looking at him, but George Halas said, no, we got to, even though the Cowboys don't have a draft, I mean, this was literally the year that they started, and they were not allowed to draft because they'd not been given official franchise status by the league yet. So they went ahead and had the draft, and George Halas said, don't take him, and then he took it. Halas drafted him in the third round and said, oh, I'm just going to trade him to the Dallas. And once they get a team, once the league makes it official, which they did several months later, and yes, he took him in the third round, traded him to the Cowboys for a third-round pick in some subsequent draft. And so he made sure that the Cowboys got Don Meredith.
It was interesting, too, to see both teams shared the Cotton Bowl Stadium, and it was kind of like this whole popularity contest to kind of see who could get the most people through the turnstiles, and they had all these crazy promotional gatherings. As somebody that was there at the time, do you kind of remember any of those or anything that particularly stood out? It seemed like they were willing to do anything to get fans through the turnstiles at that point.
Well, yeah, I remember some of them. I mean, of course, the one that's most famous is Barber Day. Lamar Hunt had Barber Day, and that was anyone wearing a white smock could get in for free. And the whole idea, Lamar always had these ideas, and the idea was back then, let's get the barbers, people in barber shops talking about the team. Maybe that'll help our popularity. I don't think it worked. And there were like 100 barbers got in for free. And he tried every, Lamar was the one, the Cowboys were more restrained. They thought, well, we've got the Chicago Bears coming in here and established teams and Jimmy Brown, and people want to see that. The AFL, Lamar said, nobody knows these guys. We got to come up with everything. So they had circuses on the field and marching bands, and they had, my favorite was the exploding scoreboard. We're going to have an exploding scoreboard. This is, of course, back in when they barely even had electric scoreboards at stadiums. And what that wound up being was a row of army mortars that they planted in the ground outside of the Cotton Bowl. And so whenever anybody scored, they set them off, and just scared the hell out of everybody, to be honest. They didn't know what it was. They thought it was some sort of military invasion or whatever. And that was the scoreboard. You know, it had nothing to do with the scoreboard. It was just some mortars just blowing up.
Good stuff. And you also cover the Ravens, the Baltimore Ravens, who, obviously won the Super Bowl this past season. Flacco led them there. And like you mentioned in some of your articles, a lot of these Ravens fans kind of like to walk to the ledge and assume everything's going to go to hell as soon as they lose some players. And you're pretty confident in this team, it seems like, going into 2013. And they're not necessarily rebuilding, but reloading for another Super Bowl run.
Well, we'll see whether they get to the Super Bowl again. I have my doubts about that. I mean, that's just the odds of, it's pretty tough to do. You need some things to break your way. The Ravens wouldn't have made it this year if they hadn't thrown a 70-yard bomb to Jacoby Jones, when they were getting ready to lose to Denver in the last minute. Some things broke their way. But, what's happened is they've made the judgment after this game, after winning the Super Bowl, that they weren't not going to get back with the same crew. Their defense was old, and it was kind of going downhill. They won the Super Bowl this year with the defense sort of going downhill. So they've made the judgment, we're gonna turn it over and bring in a new crew. And so they've cut ties with a lot of guys. Of course, Ray Lewis retired, and they let Ed Reed go to Houston. And there's been a lot of changes, but it's a pretty good front office. They have a nice track record. They've been in the playoffs 5 years in a row, 3 years out of five in the conference championship game. So they usually have a pretty good plan. They're good at managing the salary cap, and whether or not they make it back to the Super Bowl, I don't know. But I think they're going to put a decent team on the field. It'll be a different team. And they'll just see where it goes.
I would tend to agree with you. You were talking about Cowboys, Tex Schramm, and I feel like Ozzie Newsome is just so good at managing this team. And like you've alluded to in other articles, every year they kind of run into these scenarios, and that obviously comes up with the salary cap and Flacco getting the most guaranteed money in the offseason. Was that something at all that Flacco needed to feel, kind of aware of? Obviously everybody's going to press the guys like Tom Brady that took less guaranteed money to allow the team flexibility, but Flacco went out, said he was the best player in the NFL at quarterback position. He won the Super Bowl. Should he feel guilty at all, or what do you think?
No, he shouldn't feel guilty. It's different. NFL is different than baseball. The baseball union is much stronger, and as a result, all those big contracts you see in baseball, every penny is guaranteed. And so in football, the big difference is they can cut you at any time. You're right about the guaranteed money. He's got like $60 million. I mean, it's a lot of money, obviously, but not quite. It's about half of what it was reported as, and they could cut him at any time if they don't like what's going on. So, and that's true of any player in the NFL. So the mantra in the NFL is, take what you can get out of these guys for sure, because you do not have the leverage here. And for one of the few times, Joe Flacco had unbelievable leverage going into his contract negotiations, coming off a Super Bowl MVP performance. So, I say go for it, man. Get what you can. And he took it. What he signed was actually a pretty salary cap friendly contract. He's making less against the cap than he was last year. And if they'd been unable to sign him and they'd had to put the franchise tag on him, it would have been, I think, $20 million. I think he's counting like $6 million against the cap this year. So actually gave them more flexibility to make some moves and bring in Elvis Dumervil and some of these other moves that they've made. So, you know, the big money kicks in about 3 years, and we'll see what happens at that point. But that's an eternity in the NFL, and they'll cross that bridge when they get to it, as they say.
Oh, yeah. It's a what have you done for me lately league.
Sure, and, absolutely.
I did think without sounding too sad, it was kind of a happy ending, you know. They were, the contract negotiations the previous season had gotten pretty, heated, I guess, to a degree. Flacco goes in as an unrestricted free agent in the offseason. He says, I'm the best quarterback in the NFL. He goes out and wins, and Bisciotti says, all right, let's pay you the money. And so I thought that was a pretty cool ending because, like you said, the money, you're not guaranteed a contract. So he blows out his arm, and then he's thinking, I should have been greedy. I should have taken the money without a chance because this is probably his last big payday.
Oh, well, this is his biggest payday. I mean, he's in the prime of his career. His next contract would, if he does well, he'll renegotiate in 3 years. He'll make some good money then. But this is the one that sets the parameters for everything for him for the future. This was his moment. And he won the Super Bowl and he's MVP. So you won't ever find a player with more leverage than Joe Flacco had this year. You just can't have more. I mean, unless he'd been MVP in the league and thrown for 500 touchdowns or something. You know, his regular season stats were average. He was up and down in the regular season, which is why some people, I think, are kind of grumbling about it. You know, and I get that, but he was really, really good in the playoffs, and he's won a ton of games, and he's won a Super Bowl, and you just can't have more leverage than he did. So, hey, you know, more power to him.
And he went to McDonald's to celebrate, so he's a man of the people, right? Give him a break.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, that's who he is. I mean, you just can't make that stuff up. You know, he is definitely not a... let's go to, you know, get a suite at the Ritz. You know, that's just not who he is. Maybe an extra topping at Flacco Family Pizza Night or something. But, you know, he's pretty that's who he really is. It'll be interesting to see if it changes him in the long run.
After he graduated from Delaware, didn't he actually, like, live with his parents for the first season or two? I remember something like that in the news.
I don't know if he did that. You know, he transferred in from Pitt. He started out at Pitt. And that was D1, and it didn't go well. And he wound up at 1AA at Delaware. And I don't know if he lived at home, but I'm not sure. I have not heard that, but you know, he is definitely not a big spender.
We definitely make up a lot of urban legends on this show, so you caught me on that one,
okay.
I guess. So, but it's a fun story nonetheless. But you know, the book is 10-Gallon War, the NFL's Cowboys, the AFL's Texans, and the feud for Dallas's pro football future. John, thank you very much for being on the show. Best of luck to you going forward, and yeah, thank you.
All right, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, have a good night. Thanks again.
All right, sure thing.
Bye.
Bye.